Okay, we're starting the 26th class of Derech Hashem, and we're in the second section, fourth chapter, paragraph 4, but we're just going to back up a spec. So we're talking about Israel and the nations, and last time we spoke about, this whole chapter is about the difference between the Jews and regular humanity, and how the Jews became differentiated from the rest of humanity. We talked about how really moving back just into number 3, which is longer section here, that all of humanity comes from Adam and Chava, and all of humanity had the opportunity to aspire back to the initial level that all humanity was on before that first sin. And unfortunately, nobody really reached up and fully grabbed that potential for 2,000 years, approximately, until Abraham. But that was a period of time that Hashem allowed for humanity to do so, if they so chose. And humanity was generally blended, apparently, at the time. There weren't separate nations yet. Not specifically separate nations, although there must have been something because we already had the Tower of Babel and the mixing up of the languages. But that concept of 70 nations didn't occur until, according to this timeline that he gives, until after Abraham made his choice. So let me just read you that part. Let's see. Okay, so speaking about all human beings and this period of the roots, meaning that all humans were in a period of roots, root stage, as opposed to the branch stage, which we're now in, but at a root stage where if any human being would have chosen to incorporate into his or herself a particular trait, it would have stayed as an element that would have manifested later in branches. If they would get up to a certain level of incorporation of whatever element that was. So the descendants of each of these individuals are thus, I'll go back a little bit. Okay, so once that, so it was the generation of the separation, the Dor HaPlugah, it was the Tower of Babel. When that occurred, man's measure was filled, however, in the generation of the separation, God's attribute of justice then decreed that the time when men could be considered roots should come to a close. Until this time, things could become a permanent part of these roots, depending on what had transpired previously. With the generation of separation, this period came to a close. God then scrutinized all mankind, perceiving the levels that should be made permanent in that generation's members according to their deeds. These things then became a permanent part of their nature in their aspect as roots. It was thus decreed that they should each bear future generations, all possessing the qualities they were deemed appropriate for their root ancestor. So right here, let's just stop for a minute. We do have this concept. We don't have it as strong today, but you can see where it comes from, the concept of spiritual genetics. So we understand a little bit about genetics today. I'm not the most schooled, but I have kids who are very interested in genetics. But we understand that genetics are the mechanism through which traits of parents are passed on to children, physical traits. And the trait has to be there in order for it to be passed on. It doesn't mean that it will be passed on just because it's there, but it won't be passed on if it's not there. So we're all clear about that. Spiritual genetics, which is just in quotation marks, refers to the concept of traits being passed on, spiritual traits being passed on from parent to child, and sometimes, just like physical genetics, skipping some generations and being manifest later on. You could have, let's say, a recessive trait that you wouldn't see in the direct children, but you might see in grandchildren or great-grandchildren. So that can happen spiritually too, and we see such traits. For instance, a common example of that that's given in the Tanakh is Yosef. How did that work now? Yosef must have been Binyamin, because I think Esther is a descendant of Binyamin, right? Or Yosef, I'm not sure. Anyway, ancestor, of Binyamin?
Yeah.
Or Yosef, of Binyamin, right. She's a descendant of Binyamin who apparently stood in front of Rachel I think when Esav was approaching, and he was, I think with the Truffim or something, he maybe knew, and he didn't say. Anyway, there was a shtika, there was a quietness that one of Esther's, Queen Esther's ancestors held, and I'm forgetting the exact story. But one of those early Shvatim had an experience in which they held their tongue. And that ability to be quiet at that time was created a spiritual genetic that was available in Esther later on when she went into the palace and was told by Mordechai not to tell where she was born. Imagine getting married to somebody and not telling them anything about your family background, which is what Mordechai told Esther not to do. And she didn't. She was able to have that quality of silence. And she got it from that ancestor who was quiet. I think it was Rachel and the Truffim, but I'm not positive. Anyway, so we have this concept. That's an example that's given, but there's other places where things like that are shown. And we know that today, even though we're not in the root period, we can still acquire spiritual characteristics that can then be passed on to our children, even later on. So, for instance, if I will work on my anger or work on my chutzpah in whatever way, I can then, my children, they don't have to even be born from me at that time. They can just be related to me and still inherit some aspect of that. Now, we might not see it necessarily right away, and it might be in a grandchild or later on, but we do create traits that are inheritable when we work on ourselves. Or when we transform ourselves spiritually, we create traits that impact on our descendants. So one example of that, one more, not a proof, but a way to point to that, which is why I phrased it as create spiritual impact, which we usually do by working on ourselves, but one way that you can see differently is, let's say a woman, a Jewish woman, is born not religious, and she grows up, she gets married, and she conceives in Nida, and she gives birth to a child not in Tahara, and that child grows up with whatever spiritual blemish the child has, because that child is born from a Nida. If the woman later in life becomes frum, and she goes to the mikvah, even the one time, even for a postmenopausal dip, which some women do just once in their life because they became frum later on, that dip creates a retroactive spiritual tikkun for the child. So there is such a thing as affecting a spiritual transition today that affects my descendants. Anyway, there is a little bit of this in what we just read in Derech Hashem. But let's continue.
So when was the generation of separation where we stopped being roots to
Branches? Okay, so that's the Tower of Babel, which is before Avraham. Avraham was born in 1948 from the year zero. I'm not quite sure when the Tower of Babel was from the year zero, but just before him, sometime before him. Between Noach and Abraham. There's 10 generations between Noach and Abraham, so somewhere in between. Okay, so the descendants of each of these individuals were thus divided into permanent groupings, each with its own characteristics and limitations. They were destined to father future generations who would inherit these characteristics, just as members of any particular species inherit the characteristics of their forebearers. According to the highest judgment, it turned out that none of them deserved to be raised above the degraded level to which Adam and his children had fallen as a result of their sin. Not a single one had risen above it all. There was, however, one exception, and that was Avraham. He had succeeded in elevating himself, and as a result of his deeds, was chosen by God. Avraham was therefore permanently made into a superior, excellent tree, conforming to man's highest level. It was further provided that he would be able to produce branches and father a nation possessing his characteristics. The world was then divided into 70 nations, each with its own particular place in the general scheme. All of them, however, remained on the level of man in his fallen state, while only Israel was in the elevated state. So, of course, this is a recording that I hope not too many non-Jews hear, but if they do hear it, I hope that they can understand the context that this is being said in which this is being said, that this has to do with spiritual levels, and it has to do with a person's own choices in achieving them. And as we just explained, a person's own choices can affect their descendants. So, but particularly mixing together Abraham's personal choices along with his part in history, his position in history when he was part of the root period of history, so his spiritual choices had a greater impact. His personal choices had a greater impact than one would have today. Although, as we'll shortly see, and we touched upon last session, any individual can join Klal Yisrael, can join the nation of Israel through their own personal choices. But here now we're talking about nations. So it was at this point, after Abraham made his choice, and after he was recognized, after Hashem chose him, and said, and I guess concretized those traits in Abraham and solidified them so that he would be able to pass them on to his descendants, then the world was divided into 70 nations, and then, as we'll see, their judgment at that point was suspended. So what happened was the nations were created, and Abraham was there, and according to the Ramchal, then the gate was closed on the era of roots. And now we enter into the era of branches in which we are right now. Okay, so moving on to paragraph 4. So God's great love and goodness decreed that the branches of other nations should still be given a chance. So here we are in the branch period, each one of us being a branch, and each branch can still have a chance. If they desire, they still have free choice to tear themselves loose from their own roots and through their own actions include themselves among the branches of Abraham's family. This is what God meant when he told Abraham, "All the families of the earth will be blessed through you." Abraham was thus made the father of all converts. So that means all the families. It's interesting to see, because we would think, how does that sentence follow, really? All the families of the earth shall be blessed through you. How does that make him the father of all converts? But any family that chooses to join any individual who will be the head of a family, any individual who won't ever have a family, whatever it is, but that creates a blessing through attachment to Abraham. So he is the conduit through which that blessing flows, and if one attaches himself to Abraham and his descendants, one is then the beneficiary of that bracha that comes through him. And then he just reminds us that, of course, that requires effort to tear oneself away and to reattach. If one doesn't exert that effort, if a Gentile does not exert that effort, then they remain attached to their own roots and retain their natural characteristics. But every single individual human being is empowered to be able to choose, if they want to become Jewish. That's up to them. Now, I guess we'll continue and see. Nobody has to become Jewish. It's not that there's heaven and hell, and as there are in some other paradigms where only those that belong to that one religion go to heaven and everybody else goes to hell. We don't have that at all. But let's see what we do have. Okay, just understanding the concept of the branches a little bit more first. It's also necessary to realize that each individual tree is also divided, very much as the descendants of Adam were divided into root trees and branches. Primary branches can thus be distinguished in each individual tree, and these branches are then differentiated to yield their particular members. Abraham's tree consisted of 600,000 main branches. These were the individuals who left Egypt, and it was to them that the Torah was given and the land of Israel divided. So let's just look at this for a second, because I did get a question, which I so appreciate, by email. Somebody asked me two questions. So the first one is, with regard to soul stacks, I'm curious as to how you came to your theory. It seems really complicated. What would the purpose of mixing up soul chips be? Okay, so let's look at this for a second. So part of how I came to my theory of soul chips and mixing up soul pieces came from this work. So let's just see the theory that the Ramchal is putting forth. And again, let's just remind ourselves that if it's not a Dvar Halacha, if we're not learning something that has practical application in our life, we do not have to come to to one conclusion, right? A Dvar Halacha, you have to know, can you eat this or not, kosher or treif? You know, do you wait 3 hours or 6 hours or 1 hour if you're Dutch? You know, what is the, what's the decision? Whereas in things of hashkafa, there can be many even competing ideas that could all be true somehow. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim, we say about such things, when they're based on something solid. So I'm not saying that my theory is necessarily based on something solid, but I'll try to explain it a drop. But let's look first at what the Ramchal is saying here. So he's saying that Avraham's tree consists of 600,000 main branches. So we discussed before that there are 600,000 Jews who came out of Mitzrayim. Of course, the Midrash tells us that there's many more, because 600,000 refers to males between the ages of 20 and 60, and we assume that between 20 and 60 they all had a female counterpart, and that there were those who were below the age of 20, and there were those who were above the age of 60. So somehow we get to a count of about 3 million. But if there's 600,000 main branches, there's 600,000 main souls, so we have to divide those souls up by the 3 million right there, so that each one has a piece of that. Now, the Ramchal's language here, let's see. Every Jew subsequently born is considered to be an element and descendant of one of these primary branches. So an element and descendant, right? But right away we have the problem of the 3 million and the 600,000. So where's elements and descendants? Right there on the spot. And then it says it was to these 600,000 original Jews that the Torah was given. When this occurred, the tree was said to have attained maturity. So even if the tree is said to have attained maturity at the time, you still have the problem of 600,000. We have other sources as well who say that not only were all those Jews who were alive at the time there to receive the Torah, but there is a concept also that any future descendant, any future Jew was there at the time too. So whether that is Chavi's new baby, right, or whether that was me who wasn't born into a Jewish body, I don't know what the status of my soul was when I was born. So whatever it was, whether it's a ger or whether it's a new baby born much later, so there are concepts, and again, we don't have to necessarily agree on all this. There's definitely a concept that all of those souls are present at Matan Torah, that they all were able to receive the Torah at that time. So then what is that? That would work if you would say all this, that it's descendants, if you want to use the Ramchal's language here and say elements and descendants of these primary branches were the ones who received the Torah. Okay, so you have the wholeness of the branch, of those primary branches, and then every other Jew that comes after, whether they're a convert or a new baby, is a descendant of that. Or you can work with the 600,000 Jews who are there, plus their spouses, plus their children, plus their parents and grandparents, get to the 3 million. You already have to divide that 600,000, and then the question is dividing it further to all the Jews that ever lived. Where do they come from? Are we recycling souls whole? But even if we are, you have to divide that 600,000. Today we have about 14 million Jews in the world. So how is it that each Jew is animated with a soul? Even today, forget reincarnation or the amount of souls that there were since Sinai till today and will be until the end of time. You know, how many souls are there? So how do you get 600,000? So that's step number one of where I came up with this theory of soul pieces. But step number two, then, of where I came up with soul stacking, if you remember my theory.
I just asked you, why would the number then be 600,000 if there was 3 million?
Right. It's a good question. And I don't know the answer to that. That's what the Torah text says. Of course, we know that when we got the Torah, we got the written law and the oral law at the same time. And the oral law explains things. So a midrash that would come, midrashim we don't take literally as we do Torah. So, for instance, when the Torah text says that Hashem took the tzela of Adam and made it into Isha, whether that's the rib or the side or whatever it is, we do somehow on some level believe literally that a chunk of his side, whatever it was taken, and from that Isha was formed. It's not a midrash. We take that literally. Somehow, we're not quite sure how to take it literally, but on some level, it's literal. Whereas when we hear a midrash, let's say that Rivka was 3 years old when she was betrothed to Yitzhak, or when they got married, we don't take that literally. Or when we hear the story of Avraham watching over his father Terach's idol store and then smashing all the idols and then telling his father when he came back, you know, that somebody brought in a meal offering to the top idol and that one smashed them all because they were all jealous and fighting over it, right? We're not required, it's possible that just how it's written it happened, but we're not required to believe that at all. What we believe is what's true in the story. So we do believe from that story, maybe it was literal, but let's say it wasn't literal. What's true in the idol shop story is that Avraham had words with his father and disagreed with him as to the role that idols play and how they function. And Avraham's father wasn't happy with him, and Avraham took drastic action to make a point. That's all true. Was it exactly that story? That's not really what's important once you come to a midrash. So we have, but the fact that there was an exchange, that's definitely true. So now getting back to this, so we have in the text, in the Torah text, it says 600,000, right? That's how it's calculated. And then you have the oral law or midrash that comes and says 3 million. So I don't exactly know how to work out those numbers, to tell you the truth. It's not something I've done a lot of work with to really try to figure out. Some people care a lot about how the numbers really work, and is it true? There are some people who would care if they can make it work as true. And the numbers are much higher in a way than they quote-unquote should be if 70 souls went into Mitzrayim, and 210 years later, 600,000 or 3 million are exiting Mitzrayim. You have a big number problem there. But it doesn't end with the 3 million that came out. The number problem is increased when you realize that 4/5 of the Jews died during the plague of darkness, which means that there were really, 4 times 3 is 12, there were really 15 million Jews in Egypt. 12 million died during the plague of darkness, and 3 million then exited, just 1/5. So now you have a problem. How did you get from 70 to 15 million? Which is why you have a midrash that the women gave birth to sextuplets every time. And then you have the problem of, well, how do they raise 6 babies at a time? How could you nurse 6? It's so hard to nurse 1, right? When I had my twins, and I'd get up at night to nurse them, I would say, Baruch Hashem, I have twins, and Baruch Hashem, I don't have triplets. I just couldn't imagine, you know, at least with twins, you could put one on each side, but with triplets, you have to nurse 2 and bottle feed 1 and rotate and keep track of that. Just like the thought of that was, but imagine 6. How do you do 6, and how did they do 6 in Mitzrayim? So then you have Midrashim that come and say how you did 6, that they each one had a stone in his hand, and one like gave, I forgot which fluids each one gave, but they were able to nurse themselves and raise themselves so the mothers could get to getting pregnant again right away and have another 6, and they gave birth under the apple trees, and they were able to, you know, quickly grow, and all kinds of Midrashim like that that help you work on the numbers. So that being said, I haven't actually sat and done research on the numbers and how I can justify making them right. It's not one of my particular areas of interest. I haven't done the work. I'm at this point willing to accept what the text says, 600,000. I'm not exactly sure how that was. But meanwhile, 600,000 original Jews, according to the Ramchal, got the Torah. And that's when the tree itself was called mature. So at this point, after the Torah is given, at the time of the giving of the Torah, there was a suspension in judgment for each one of the nations. So from going back to our timeline a little bit, from the Dor HaFlaga, from the generation of separation, which is the Tower of Babel, when all the that people on Earth were divided into their 70 nations. All their character traits were fixed in them. And just think about Europe and what it looks like. Each nation has its own flavor, even though they're so close to each other. I wish I could remember right now. There's a great joke about the difference between heaven and hell. Right? Heaven is where the French are cooks and the Italians are the lovers and the English are the policemen and the Germans are the manufacturers. And hell is where, no offense, but the English are the cooks and the Germans are the policemen and the Italians and the, let's see, the Italians are the manufacturers, I think, and the French are the, I forgot what the other one is. Anyway, you can mix it up, right? So you can see that the character traits of the different nations work well for some things and terribly for others. And they're right next door to each other. So that each nation does have its own energy. That's the point. So each nation is divided into, the character traits are solidified in that nation. They're divided into 70 root nations. We have more than that today, but they're divided into 70 nations. And then the question is, what's their place going to be in the scheme of everything? And Hashem, because they haven't, as a nation, the reason why they've been divided into those nations is they didn't reach up to grab the potential that was floating above them, the potential that they fell from with that first sin of Adam and Chava. They didn't reach up. The only one that did was Abraham. Right? So now their judgment is suspended until Matan Torah. And we're all familiar with the Midrash that before Hashem gave the Torah to the Jews, he offered it to all of the nations. Right? So, and how did he offer it to all the nations? We'll see just in a few paragraphs that each nation at that time, when they were divided into 70, each nation was then assigned a malach that was its principal caretaker. That Hashem took a step back. He no longer had direct intervention with each one of the nations. He put another layer between him and each of the nations. So Hashem interacts with the Jews directly and with each of the 70 nations indirectly through a malach. So when Hashem offered the Torah, and we all know that Midrash, right? Hashem goes to each nation, says, do you want the Torah? And they say, what's in it, right? And so to one group, he says, there's no stealing. They say, oh, forget it. We love to steal. And then to another group, he says, do you want the Torah? And they say, what's in it? And he says, no murder. They say, oh, forget it. We love to kill, right? And to another, he offers it, and he says, well, it says in there, no sexual immorality. They say, oh, forget it. We love to sleep around, right? So, and then, of course, the Jews, you know, said, we'll take it, not save Nishma, without asking what's in it. But until that point, the judgment of each of the nations was suspended. They had the opportunity, still Hashem waited, for them to grab the Torah and join those people who would use the Torah to grow themselves and transform the world. And none of them did. But if you think about the Midrash, what did Hashem do? Did he gather them like he gathered the Jewish people? Did all the people of each nation come together in a group to say no thank you to the Torah? That's not what happened. What happened is Hashem spoke to their malach. So when Hashem spoke to the malach, and again, who knows exactly how this works, but it's the malach who carries the energy and represents the people who said no thank you. But apparently there were individuals in each nation that did want it. So the nation and the national energy was no. But some individuals said yes. And at that time, they became destined to become converts in the future. Because they did accept it. At the time, they just were not in the right place to accept it. But they were able to go through the generations until they were in a position to be able to convert in and yes, accept it. Because of that, because of some things like that, I have my theory of soul stacks. Because there we have to figure out how you get from 600,000 root souls, in this case branches, they're called branches in the language of the Ramchal, so how do you get from 600,000 primary branches to all the souls of all the Jews? But I think her question is not just how do you get to all those souls, slicing up those original souls into many and giving one to each Jew, but how do you then, on top of that, work into that the problem of reincarnation. And once you have reincarnation, you have to ask why there's reincarnation. So we discussed before that reincarnation is for those people who need it and those people who deserve it. meaning they have worked on themselves enough that they deserve to come back, but they fell short of the mark enough that they need to come back. So, but what does that mean then? That means they have to have some element of that original soul, or the soul that they failed to perfect, has to be in the new body. But it's not
the
same.
I just ask a question regarding the original 3 million. The 600,000 were representative for the rest of the people, for the rest of the 3 million, or there was a connection, there was...
No, all 3 million were there. That's the conundrum, because the text says 600,000, but the Midrash says 3 million, because 600,000 is referring just to the men.
Right, so does that mean that they're all root souls?
Those are all root souls. That's what it's saying. So does it mean all 3 million are all root souls? No, I don't think so. I think, you know, in the concept that we have of, let's say, for instance, Ishto Kegufo, right, that there is a yichud between the husband and wife, and they share a soul. So in that sense, the 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60, their other half of their soul was there with them. Put those two together, so now you've got 1.2 million human beings, but that between the 1.2 million human beings, there's only 600,000 souls.
Mm-hmm. And parents and kids.
And then you have parents and kids, so then you have to ask what to do with that, which is why I have this soul chip theory.
Right.
Because otherwise, I mean, and again, it's just my theory. I'm planning on going to New York in 2 weeks. I'm hoping to spend some time with some teachers there that could help me understand it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wants to share this kind of information, it turns out. I've asked a few questions in different times and been looked upon. You know, like, why do you want to know? Why do you want to delve into deeper areas? It's interesting. I've asked questions of one of my principal teachers here, and he's often answered me cryptically and occasionally with just a source. And then I was learning through the Rambam, and right, he says specifically in the Rambam, he says there's certain Torah that's not supposed to be revealed, and you can teach it directly in small groups, sometimes just one-on-one, and some particular Torah, which I'm sure I don't have access to, but some particular Torah can't be taught even one-on-one. The only way you can teach that Torah is through the Hameven Yavin method, right, where you just give a source. And if the person has acquired enough information that when that person looks at the source then answers their question, then they get the answer.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't answer it.
Right.
So I think that it's a fascinating concept. So we'll see what I get to learn from all this. But so I'm just giving my theory. excuse me. Okay. So, all right. So we have these 600,000 root souls from which all other Jewish souls stem. And then the reason why I have this, not just soul chips, but the stacking or the reintegrating of soul chips in different people through different incarnations is because if you look at us today, we're all different reincarnations of different aspects of the past. In order to answer questions like, if I'm a reincarnation, or if at the resurrection I'm going to be the wife of somebody, whose wife will I be? Will I be the wife of Ephraim Bulow in this lifetime, or of Shmulek Levinson in the 1880s, or of, I don't know, Avraham Ben, you know, Moshe in the 900s? You know, which husband is my husband, and how does all that work? It gets very complicated once you start to introduce reincarnation and resurrection and put the whole picture together. It gets quite complicated, which is why I came up with my theory. It just helps to figure it out a little bit, but I'm not saying that's necessarily true. And again, just reminding you that in things of Hashkafa, we don't know exactly what it is. Most of what's being put forth is theories. And, of course, the Ramchal and people like that who have real weight behind them have very solid theories, but they're still theories, and that's what we're learning, because nobody knows for sure, even though the Ramchal had some revelation. But still, it's a general concept of what it will be. Okay, moving forward to paragraph 6. So now that the nations are separated out, right, and there's and Abraham is the one who's elevated, and individuals can still attach themselves, convert to Judaism by their own free will. Now the question is, what do you do with the rest of the nations? That's where paragraph 6 comes in. The decree, however, was not that the other nations should be destroyed. It only meant that they would have to remain on the lower level that we have discussed. This lower state would never have been meant for man if Adam had not sinned. It only came into being in the first place as a result of his sin. These nations still have the human aspect, blemished though it may be, and God desired that they should at least have a counterpart of what was actually appropriate for all mankind. He therefore granted them a divine soul, somewhat like that of the Jew, even though it's on a much lower level. So it's important for us to realize and just make sure that we know that all human beings have divine souls. We don't believe that non-Jews don't have a soul. That is not a Jewish belief. It may be the belief of some Jews, but it's not a Jewish belief. All human beings have a divine soul. Different. We're different spiritual species. Jews are different than non-Jews, but we all have a divine soul. They're likewise given commandments through which they could attain both material and spiritual advantages appropriate to their nature. And these are the 7 universal commandments given to the children of Noach. And those are 6 don'ts and 1 do. I didn't write them down, but I'll see if I can remember them. The 1 do is to create courts of justice to enforce the 6 don'ts, basically. So courts of justice is the do. And the don'ts are no immoral sexual relations, no blasphemy, no murder, no idol worship, no Eivor Mina Chai, and one more. let's see, look at that. So no blasphemy, maybe no stealing, no murder, no blasphemy, no Eivor Mina Chai, no idol worship. Whatever, that's 5 of them. Excuse me. So, and they are actually very big, just like we have mitzvot. We have 613 mitzvot with lots of small print, so we really have more than 613 mitzvot. The same thing with Gentiles. They have 7 major mitzvot, but their 7 are basically root mitzvot with lots of fine print also. So that it really does inform their lives if they try to keep them carefully. Let's see. All this has been arranged from the beginning of creation, prepared for the contingency that man would sin. In this respect, it is like other harmful things and punishments, which were also created conditionally, as our sages teach us. Okay, let's end there. And I have 1 question, a 2nd question to answer that I got an email, which is really just jumping ahead for a minute. So here's the 2nd question. Let's see, the concept of a nefesh behema. Could I explain it? What is it? Do animals have souls? So that's actually jumping ahead a little bit, but I'll answer the question because it does have to do with what we're learning about now. So there's the human soul that all human beings have, the Jewish soul, which is differentiated from the human soul. It's on a different, it's really a different spiritual species, but is also a divine soul, so 2 different types of human souls. And then there's what's called the nefesh, or the animal soul. So I'm just going to read to you from the paragraph that discusses it, and that's in section 3, chapter 1, the soul and its influence, which we'll get to in the future, but I'll read it anyway. As we've already discussed, there's 1 way in which man is different from anything else that was created. He is a combination of 2 different diverse elements, namely the body and the soul. When we speak of man's soul, however, we are actually speaking of 2 different things. 1 type of soul that man has is the same as that which exists in all living creatures. It is this animal soul that is responsible for man's natural feelings and intelligence. This type of soul also exists in all living creatures and is a very ethereal entity. It is transmitted through the genetic material at the time of conception and then continually spreads, constructing a body appropriate for each particular species. As the creature matures, it continues to grow, and it is responsible for the existence of its senses as well as the intelligence appropriate for the particular species. As a result of this, the intelligence of different animal species can vary greatly. The intellect of man, however, is very different from that of animals. As a result of the animal soul following its natural character, as well as the readiness of the instruments that serve it, all this is a result of the animal soul. These in turn will vary with each individual species. In man's animal soul, certain attributes and faculties can also be distinguished. These include imagination, memory, intelligence, and will. All of these are faculties contained in this animal soul, each one having its own particular domain and unique function. So that's his paragraph on the animal soul. So all living creatures have that. Animals and humans have really something that's what I refer to as the animating soul. That's that which keeps us alive. It's technically physical. It's the most ethereal of all physical things. It's not actually spiritual. So while we call it a soul, we don't call it a neshama. We call it a nefesh. And we'll see later on, it gets a little bit confusing because the human soul, one of the paradigms that the human soul is divided through is a five-level paradigm, where the lowest is the nefesh, then comes the ruach, then comes the neshama, then the chaya and the yechida. So the lowest level of the human neshama, that whole thing, those five layers, is called the neshama. The lowest level is called the nefesh, and that can be quite confusing because that lowest level is called the same thing that the animal soul is called, the nefesh. But they're two totally different things. The animal soul is connected to the body through the blood, and the human soul is connected to the body through the animal soul. So we'll discuss it further when we get to it, but it's a totally different thing, and it's not actually spiritual. So even though it's responsible for those traits that I just mentioned, which is pretty fascinating to think about, intelligence and memory and will, looking back, let's see, imagination, memory, intelligence, and will, that's all in the animal soul for us too. Those are not our spiritual things. It's things outside of imagination, memory, intelligence, and will that's our spiritual neshama.
Will is a spiritual thing.
Pardon?
Will is from the animal soul. That sounds so interesting.
Yeah, I think that we probably have a spiritual. We have a spiritual will too, but the will that we have a rut zone, right? And we part of our rut zone, we have a dueling rut zone. That's why we say b'chol levavacha, really lave. Is our heart, right? And it should be b'chol libcha or levcha, but it's levavacha. We should love Hashem with all levavacha. So Rashi says both our hearts, the heart that wants the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, right? So that if you want to talk about the Yetzer as a force that moves us, will and drive, that's what the Yetzer is, right? Once some Chachamim daven that the Yetzer Hara should be taken away, and it was, and then nobody got up and went to work, and nobody procreated, nobody did anything, because there's no Yetzer. So if you just say Yetzer, Yetzer means driving force or will, desire to go, right? Could be good, could be bad, but before you label it Ra or Tov, there's Yetzer. So that's will in a way. So the rut zone to do stuff. So, but if you think about it, that first moment that you wake up in the morning, you have two conflicting wills, you know, one that says roll over and go back to sleep, and the other that says get up and start your day, be productive, be spiritual, go, let's soar today, right? So, and it's really hard because your body is speaking quite loudly and your neshama is also speaking and doesn't usually speak as loudly, which is why the first halacha on the Shulchan Aruch is to get up right away, right? Be strong like a lion and get up right away. Allow your soul to dominate your body. So, so I think that there's also in the neshama a rut zone or a will, but for sure in the animal soul, in the animal nefesh, the animating force, there's a rut zone, and that's what drives you to do all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And it's the spiritual soul that has to exert its influence. So the animal soul, for instance, could create the desire to steal. You know, to grab that. I want that thing. Somebody left their purse open. You could so easily take their wallet. You want extra money. Why don't you take it? because your soul is exerting influence on you, saying it's not yours. Stay away from other people's property, right? You have no right. But if it was just an animal soul talking, you could just take it. So we have conflicting things going on, but there is definitely a will in the animal soul, and we try to conquer it and condition it. That's part of why we have mitzvot, is to condition ourselves into kedusha by behaving in certain ways that conquer certain drives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think that's probably enough for this time. Any other questions?
No, I think
no. Thank you very much.
Okay, terrific. So, all right, next week, same time. You know, Javi and Hannah, if maybe the two of you, when I send out the email, you'll have each other's emails on it. If you want to correspond and figure out a different time that works, so you don't have to be up in the middle of the night, if there's another time that works well for both of you, I don't mind switching times.
What about you? When are you available?
I'm 2 hours behind Hannah. So the only time, and for the summer, I'm available pretty much all the time. Because usually the only commitment I generally have is Monday mornings from 9 to 11. I teach two classes back to back. Otherwise, I'm flexible. Excuse me, and I travel. But I'm willing to make it work. Or maybe I'll just send out that question to the group if they want to find a different time that works better.
That would be good.
Yeah, because it's lovely to have you on the line, but I hate to have you get up in the middle of the night or
stay up. This time I'm not getting up, but yeah.
So I'll send that question out, and then we can see if we can find a time that will work well for everybody, even if it's experimental. Try it for a month and see how that works.
Lovely.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
All right. So have a great week. Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye.